Starts everywhere January 19th.
Good morning. Welcome to Radioactivity. I'm Rob Lori. Coming up, we're going to talk about the way Florida treats its children. We'll speak with one of the state's leading advocates for children in just a moment. Later, we'll open the phone lines. But first, two listener comments about yesterday's program. Yesterday, we talked about the upcoming session of the state legislature, including a bill that would make it easier to decertify unions. And we heard Oprah Winfrey's speech from the Golden Globes Awards on Sunday night. Here's what two listeners had to say.
I listened to your show this morning. I heard about the bill before the Florida legislature that would decertify any union that didn't have 50% due-paying membership. I am a state worker. I am a member of our union. This bill is an attempt to bust unions and take away their power. I would like to see you have an interview with Gwen Graham, who is running for Florida governor as a Democrat in 2018, Bob Graham's daughter. I would love to hear from her and her opinion of this bill, which it may have a chance to pass now that Jack Latvala is out of the Florida Senate. And I'd love to see you do an interview with Gwen, and not only because she could be our next governor, but because this bill is very dangerous to unions, and I'd love to hear her opinion of this bill.
This is Betty from Sarasota. I wanted to comment on today's show regarding Oprah's speech yesterday on the Golden Globes for her Lifetime Achievement Award. Well deserved. She's brilliant. Her words were so necessary and fabulous and powerful and deep, and she spoke to millions of people, really, not just about abuse through every spectrum, but she also spoke about the freedom of the press and many other important and cogent issues of the day. So I'm hoping that she runs for president in 2020, and it wouldn't surprise me if she did. I think she's ripe and ready. I think the country is too. So thank you for an excellent program. WMNF has been my spiritual and intellectual lifeline since moving to Sarasota 15 years ago. You've done a phenomenal job.
Well, there you have two listener comments that came in after yesterday's program. You're listening to WMNF in Tampa. 30,000 kids in Florida will be in what's called out-of-home care, mainly foster care, during any given year. 30% of those children will have three or more placements. Almost 900 kids in state supervision are injured every year while under state protection. On average, these kids remain in state care for 2 years and 7 months. Our guest is Robin Rosenberg, who is with a group called Florida's Children First, and she's trying to get the attention of the State Constitution Revision Commission because she says that the kids need to get something on the ballot this year. And Robin Rosenberg, welcome to WMNF. Great to see you.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
So 30,000 kids essentially under state supervision every year, foster care?
In out-of-home care. So a good chunk of them are placed with relatives. About 40% of them are placed in licensed placements, which are either foster homes, and a good chunk of our older kids are placed in group homes. So they're not even in a family setting. They're in a group or congregate setting.
And why are the kids placed in these homes? What's happening at home that would take them out of their home?
So about 70% of our kids come into foster care because of parental neglect. People don't get up in the morning, you know, they get up and plan to rob a bank. They don't get up and plan to abuse or neglect their children. Most often, the parents have problems that have taken control of their life, and they're not capable of giving the children the care that they need. The biggest causes are substance abuse, mental health, and domestic violence. And when families don't have the means to surround the children and take care of them while their parents are experiencing problems, and especially with poor families, they're increased likelihood to come to the attention of the system, to get a call to the abuse hotline, which results in an investigation and ultimately a determination that the child can't remain safely at home. And so they have to be removed from their parents and put into state care. We have too many kids in state care. Hillsborough County in particular is in a crisis right now. We have a system that's designed for 2,800 kids that is serving 4,000 kids in out-of-home care. So we've got to get the kids who don't need to be in state care, they need to go home so that we can really provide the best services for the children that need to be there.
Is our state better or worse than other states?
Well, and both. You know, there are a lot of things that Florida is really a national leader on, but being a national leader is not what I say. It's cold comfort to the child who is experiencing that out-of-home care in a negative way, or who wants to go back to their parents and can't manage to do that. So there are a lot of things that we do well on, but in the child welfare system, we can always do better, and that's what we're trying to do with the proposed constitutional amendment.
All right, so what are you asking the State Constitution Revision Commission to do?
There is a proposal filed by Commissioner Belinda Kaiser. It's proposal number 40, and it would put in the state constitution the right of every child who had been removed from their parents, placed into out-of-home care, the right for that child to have their own attorney. Florida is in the minority of states that does not automatically provide every child in foster care with their own attorney. So back in the 70s, when the federal government started to say to the states, children have to have representation in court, Florida began doing that through the Guardian Ad Litem program, which was the first in the nation to have a statewide Guardian Ad Litem program. And we chose to do this with lay volunteers who other states would call a court-appointed special advocate, a CASA.
They show up in court, and when there's a hearing regarding the children's status, they're there to advocate on behalf of the children?
Well, their role is to investigate, to research, to report. And when they started out, they were actually attached to the court, and they were sort of the eyes and ears of the court. Their role has changed over time as they've added a cadre of attorneys and staff people that now work together as a team. So the volunteer, sometimes a staff advocate, but usually volunteer, is charged with going out, getting to know the kid, looking at all the facts, talking to the people, learning about what's going on in the kid's life, making those reports to the court, and they're charged statutorily with representing the best interests of the child. But the guardian ad litem and the child don't have an attorney-client relationship. And, you know, when foster care in the 70s, nobody had an attorney in court. The parents were in court without an attorney. The state didn't have an attorney. We now have a very highly court-focused process in which every party to the case, except the child, has an attorney. And the one person who has to live the most with the decisions that are made in court are the children themselves. The court decides, will they go home? Where will they live, which means where will they go to school? So all of the key decisions in a child's life that happen in the what we call the dependency court system are made by judges. Judges make the best decisions with the best facts and the best legal argument, and everyone there has an attorney except for the child.
So you're saying guardian ad litem is good, but not good enough? There needs to be an extra layer of help for the kids?
They are separate and important functions. And what we want Florida to have is the best model in the country. So there are states where every kid gets an attorney, but they don't get a guardian ad litem. We want to be the state where every kid gets both. They have separate and important functions. And when we talk about on the court side of things, the liberty interests that are at stake for children are so critical, and the need for children, as all other parties, to have due process is so important that those needs can only be met with that direct attorney-client relationship.
Now, you're asking the State Constitution Revision Commission to take a look at this. This is the commission that's meeting largely out of the public eye, and it has a really powerful capability, and that is to put the issue on the ballot before the voters this November,
right,
and then voters will decide whether or not kids should have representation in court. Has the Constitution Revision Commission looked at this issue, and is it possible it's going to be on the ballot in November?
So all of the proposals that are before the Revision Commission have been assigned to committees, and similar to the legislature, they have to pass out of their first committee to make it to their second committee. This proposal was assigned to two committees, the first committee being the Declaration of Rights, because this would create a right in that section of the Florida Constitution. That committee has not put it on the calendar yet for consideration. We expect that that will happen in the next 2 or 3 weeks. They're just doing like a week at a time calendar. But the rules of the commission say that all of the proposals will be heard, at least in their first commission.
When will the commission finish its work and come up with a final list of possible amendments?
They're required to be done in May, and then things would make it on the ballot in November. As a practical matter, I think they're anticipating concluding their work in January, this first round, in January and February, and then taking what they've done back out to the public. So they will be in St. Petersburg in, I can't remember if it's February or March. So they did a round of road trips before. They're doing their committee work now, and then they will do another round of road trips to get public input on all of the proposals at 6 or 7 locations around the state.
All right, so if this makes their list, when they come to St. Petersburg, people who want this should show up.
Absolutely. And if people want to support the support it now, it's really important to call the people who are on the commission. So locally, Senator Joyner is on the first committee for the commission. Senator Lee and Bill Schifino from the Florida Bar is a Tampa lawyer. They are on the second committee for the commission.
And when you say Senator Lee, Tom Lee?
Tom Lee.
Okay.
Is on the commission.
Arthenia Joyner, who just stepped down from the state Senate last year.
Yeah. Right. And there are list of
Daryl Rousson. Is Daryl Rousson the state representative from St. Pete?
He is on the commission. He's not on the first two committees, but of course, we want all the commissioners to know the public support. And so we've heard that other initiatives from folks are getting public support, and those calls are important just to let people know, I care about kids in foster care. I'd like to see this on the ballot.
Could you give us an example where somebody, a child, let's say, you know, a 10-year-old or a 7-year-old has a guardian ad litem, but they don't have an attorney, and an issue where having an attorney would be really important to them when they go into court?
Sure. So kids have individual legal rights that are attached to them. They derive from a bunch of different places. So an attorney is trained to spot those legal issues. So that child may have a parent who is deceased, or maybe it's a parent who's in jail but was retired before they went into jail, who gets Social Security benefits. That child has a right to that benefit. That's a legal issue that they can spot. A lot of our children end up getting prescribed psychotropic medication because of their behavior. Normal behavior for an abnormal situation can look like abnormal behavior. They may or may not want to take the medication. They may want that direct advocacy for their position. So the guardian ad litem's job is to determine what they think is in the best interest of the child. So they may look at that situation and say, I think this kid needs to take this medication to be under control where they're living. And the child may say, this is what the medication does to me, and I don't want to take the medication. So in those cases now, the guardian ad litem will often ask for an attorney to be appointed to represent the child. So I don't want to say that no kids are getting represented now. We calculate about 10% of kids in Florida are currently being represented. So sometimes there's a direct conflict between what the guardian ad litem thinks is in the child's best interest and what the child says they want. There are other things that an attorney can advocate for services. For the parents, for example, if the kid wants to go home, they want to go home and they want to stay home. And that means the parent needs to be in the right position to have all of those, be able to meet the needs of their child. So an attorney for a child can work with a parent's attorney in advocating to get those appropriate services so that the kid can go home and stay home safely.
We're talking with Robin Rosenberg, who's with the group Florida's Children First. We're talking about the group's advocacy. They're advocating a new constitutional amendment, and they're hoping that the Constitutional Revision Commission is paying attention to it, and that is to provide legal representation for kids who are in out-of-home care here in the state of Florida. That's largely foster care, but it could be other things too. And our phone number is 813-239-9663. Our email address is dj@wmnf.org. Some of these kids in foster care suffer injuries when they're in foster care.
The likelihood of that happens increases as foster care becomes overcrowded, and we convince foster parents to take in more kids than maybe they're actually capable of supervising or managing, or we put more children into group homes and they can't be as well supervised. So sometimes they're injured by other children in care. Sometimes they're injured by the adults who are caring for them. And so, you know, when we go in and when we take a child away from their parents, clearly the state is doing that with the promise that we're going to put you somewhere better.
Safer
and better. And so if we can't always meet that promise. And I think sometimes when the people are removing children, they just think they're solving this crisis right now. But where the kids end up, like a third of kids in the state are sent out of county. So you not only have lost your friends and family in your home and your bedroom, but you're not even in the same county as the people that you love and care about, let alone being put in a group home across the county and going, you know, deeper end into eventually maybe putting into a locked residential treatment. And so we really have to be careful about that the treatment isn't worse than the initial harm. Clearly, there are children that have to be separated from their parents and removed and cannot go back to them. But even when we talk to the young adults who were formerly in foster care about their relationship with their parents, even when they know they can't go live with that parent, they're still part of that family. They want to maintain that connection. And that's something else a lawyer can do for children, is really help them maintain the relationships and the communication with the people that are important to them, even if they can't be the people that they live with.
These would be private attorneys that would be assigned, or would this be a state agency that would hire attorneys?
So the constitutional amendment itself does not address how the attorneys would be appointed. I can tell you currently the way children get attorneys, there's a statute that provides a small number of kids lawyers, is done through a registry system where private attorneys contract with the Justice Administrative Commission. But there is also an initiative working in the Florida bar right now that is taking another look at that to come up with recommendations on a better way to provide attorneys for kids. So if all children were able to get lawyers, we would be able to not just use individual attorneys, but use programs like Legal Aid. Here in Tampa, the Legal Aid program has two attorneys that represent young children in foster care. They do an amazing job. They're full-time. They have the support of a social worker. They have the resources they need to really do a kick-butt job for their little kid clients. And that's the type of representation that we'd like to see. We want every kid, and frankly, every parent, to have high-quality representation. And, you know, one of the first things people come up with, well, how much is it going to cost? And we looked at that, and actually the savings are almost double the cost. If we just, the only program that's been studied that provides attorneys for children happens to be in Florida, in Palm Beach County. Their kids got out of foster care 88 days faster than the children that didn't have an attorney. When you multiply that by the average daily board rate for kids that are in licensed out-of-home care, you get a kid out a month early, you've already paid for the attorney, and everything else is gravy. And Florida's child welfare system is probably going to face a major change in how we're funded federally, and that's going to be even more important. Right now, we're not paid on a per-night basis for kids, but if things don't change in the U.S. legislature, that's going to come back into play in Florida. And shortening that length of stay is going to be a big financial benefit to the state.
How can people find more, or can they contact you?
Certainly they can contact me. My name is Robin Rosenberg. I'm at Florida's Children First. Our website is floridaschildrenfirst.org. My contact information is on there.
That's good. I want to widen out. First of all, on the front page of the Tampa Bay Times today, big story: opioid crisis herds kids into foster care. I'll just read the first two paragraphs. It's by Justine Griffin. She writes, "Add another negative consequence to the opioid epidemic's far-reaching impact. Prescription drug abuse is driving more children into Florida's foster care system, according to a new study from the University of South Florida. The study published in this month's issue of Health Affairs shows that addiction to painkillers such as oxycodone or morphine has contributed to more than just the dramatic rise in overdose deaths and healthcare costs," says Troy Quast, a USF researcher and the study's lead author. Quast analyzed the association between the rate of opioid prescriptions in Florida and the number of children removed from their homes due to neglect. He and his team found that 2 out of every 1,000 children in Florida were removed from their homes due to parental neglect from 2012 to 2015. a staggering 129% increase over the three-year period. And they also found that the number of opioids prescribed by doctors during the same 3 years rose 9% from 72 prescriptions for every 100 residents in 2012 to 81 prescriptions 3 years later. So the opioid crisis fueling the rise of kids in foster care. And you mentioned this is one of the main reasons kids go into foster care.
Yes, substance abuse has always been a primary reason that children have come into our foster care system. The folks that track the data can show you over time, because they have been tracking locally the particular type of substances. It ebbs and flows with the popular drug of the day. But when parents are addicted and their addiction prevents them from capably caring for their children, those kids, if the family can't surround them and take care of those kids, those children end up coming into care. And it's a tragic situation, especially for young children. So half of our kids in care are really little guys. An older kid can manage for themselves if their parent is not available, but the babies can't. And so somebody's got to take care of them.
And your group, Florida's Children First, what would you say? I mean, what would you call on the state to do to address this issue?
Well, it's really about providing family and community services. And I believe that a lot of families can solve their own problems if they're brought together and given those resources. So for example, if the baby is born at the hospital and the mother and the parents are incapable of dealing with them, can we bring that family together to come up with a plan of safe care for that baby so that the baby can be discharged to the family to raise? Now, it may be grandma's perfectly capable of taking care of that kid, but she works a full-time job and you can't put a newborn into daycare. Can we get those services at home that make it okay for her to be able to raise that baby? And if we don't and we go to foster care, then we're spending a whole pile of money to solve a problem that a family could have solved itself. So it's flexibility in funding and, to the extent possible, helping the families take care of their own problems so that those kids don't have to come into care.
Oh, I was reading in this story in Health Affairs that this problem of opioid addiction is really high in the white community, higher than in other communities. Pretty amazing.
Yes, it is.
Robin, I want to ask you one last question, and maybe we'll go to the phones because we do have a phone call. You're listening to a live interview here on WMNF in Tampa with Robin Rosenberg of the group Florida's Children First. And here's Grant from Largo who's calling in. Hi, Grant. Do you have a question?
No, I just wanted to make a statement that the guardian ad litem is basically does what the DCF people tell that guardian to do. They don't really care about the child's best interest. In cases where DCF is called in my case, it was 20 years ago, and my son was, due to false allegations that were called in anonymously, my son was taken from me and given to his mother, who had just gotten out of prison for crack cocaine. And she had him for 5 years, and she basically dropped him back off on my doorstep when he was 12 and a half and said that she couldn't take care of him any longer because she was on the run from the law again due to drugs.
Yeah, but Grant, is it fair to say that in your case, I mean, you had a bad experience with a guardian ad litem, but is it fair to extrapolate that to the whole system? Because I can say that I know guardian ad litems, and they're very conscientious.
Okay, well, that's fair to say. In my case, though, I worked, I had a job, I maintained a home, I wasn't a drug addict, I had remarried, got a new wife who never had any criminal record. She was a registered nurse, clean slate. And when, after the case was closed, the guardian still came in and voiced the DCF's wishes that the child stay with the mother, who had a long history of drugs and criminal past and being unstable, as to being with a parent who had always been in that child's life.
All right. Well, Grant,
and provided.
Grant, thanks. Thanks for sharing what happened to you. Robin, what would you say? I mean, if you were in Grant's position, what would you say? What would you do?
I talk to parents like Grant a lot and other people that are involved in the system. And some people have great experiences with all of the folks in the system, and other people have particular problems. And it's really challenging because what we want to have happen is the best possible representation for Grant. I mean, as a parent, his side should have been well represented with an attorney who could make the argument and demonstrate why it was best for that child, for his child to be returned to him. And I know a lot of people have experienced frustrations with how they're treated in the system, which is why we're trying to work overall to improve the quality of representation for everyone in the system. And actually, it's a recommendation of the federal government that our child welfare system will work best when all of our parties have high quality representation.
All right. And Grant, did you have an attorney with you?
I had an attorney, but my son didn't have one.
Yeah.
And the child needs to be able to vocalize what their desires are to someone who will represent just their interest and what they feel is, you know, what they'd like.
Well, it sounds like you agree that the kid should have an attorney.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. They should have an attorney.
All right, Grant, thank you so much.
Thank you, sir.
Thanks. Yeah, Robin, I want to ask you one last question. A lot of kids age out of foster care. And just anecdotally, around the Tampa Bay area, I see a lot of homeless teens. And you know, maybe it's a wrong assumption, but I think some of them are kids who have aged out of foster care and now have no support network. Is my assumption close to being true? Is there a problem with kids aging out of foster care with really no resources once they age out?
So two separate things. So if you look at the national data and the Florida data on the adults who are homeless, a very high percentage of them had been in foster care when they were children. That is absolutely true. And certainly there are, in our current area, young people who are homeless who had previously been in care. We were successful, my organization, working with several other people, in changing the legislation so that children don't have to age out at 18. They can remain in state care until the age of 21 or 22 if they have a disability. Florida, and this is actually an area where Florida is a leader. We really excel in what we can offer to young people. So if they can either remain in foster care, so we provide their room and board, preferably if they're in a foster home, they get to stay in the same place. That doesn't work in practice all the time, but that's the idea, until they finish high school or they're working in a job and can make a transition. For those who can go into secondary education, not only does Florida provide free tuition, but we also provide a living stipend of $1,200 a month to help them pay their expenses to finish their education. So we're way beyond many other states in what we do. In practice, there's a disconnect. And one of the really successful things we've been able to do with Lawyers for Children is here in Tampa, there is a pro bono project called Crossroads for Florida Kids. And over 100 attorneys that are in whatever practice they're in, but provide legal services to children. And Eckerd, the local provider for child welfare, has recognized the value of those attorneys representing their older kids. Because those options and things, there's a lot of legal decisions that are made and binding decisions that are made about where you live when you're 17 can affect what you're eligible for when you're 18. And so getting those children attorneys so that they get direct advice about what the law says, what they're entitled to. You know, you can go live with your uncle, but if he gets guardianship of you, then you don't get Medicaid till 26. If you're just living with him when you turn 18, you get Medicaid to 26. So those decisions are really important. And Eckerd has seen and has promoted getting attorneys, volunteer attorneys, to those kids because of so many critical things that happen at the end of their stay in care that can affect their future.
Do 100% of kids who age out have one of these volunteer attorneys?
Eckerd has committed to identifying all the kids who don't already have attorneys, and Crossroads has committed to finding attorneys to represent them. That's just here in Hillsborough County. It's not a state. We would love to see it statewide, right? Because so many important decisions are made at that time, and you need legal advice to make legal decisions.
Well, Robin Rosenberg, thanks for coming by WMNF today and explaining the status of kids, especially kids in foster care.
Thanks for having me. And again, we want all kids to have a lawyer and a guardian ad litem.
And how can people find out more? How can they contact you?
They can contact Florida's Children First It's floridaschildrenfirst.org is our website. You can learn more about our organization, and my contact information is in there as well.
Robin Rosenberg, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
You're listening to 88.5 FM. This is WMNF in Tampa. In just a moment, we're going to open up the phone lines and talk about some other issues that are in the news. Music from Oliver Mitikudzi. You're listening to WMNF in Tampa, 88.5 FM. I'm going to mention a few news articles, and then we're going to open up the phone lines and take your phone calls. Our phone number, 813-239-9663. Email address is dj@wmnf.org. And usually what happens is that the first few calls steer the show. Hear a story that you want to comment about, be sure to call in right away, or you can also send your message via email to, again, dj@wmnf.org. The first story happening in Tampa this morning, prosecutors are seeking a 11-year sentence for a neo-Nazi group leader who stockpiled explosive material in his North Tampa apartment where a friend killed their two roommates. The prosecutors say today's defendant is an unrepentant ideologue who poses a serious danger if he gets out, when he gets out. And the sentencing of 22-year-old Brandon Russell was scheduled to take place at 9 a.m. this morning in federal court in Tampa. He was part of an obscure neo-Nazi group that formed on the internet. They called their group Atom Waffen Division, which is German for atomic weapon. And the union representing public school teachers in Sarasota County is encouraging teachers and school district employees to picket outside of the Sarasota School District's administrative office this afternoon, following 4 months of contract negotiations between the union and the district that have stalled. Sarasota Herald Tribune is reporting that contract negotiations have gone on longer than either side had hoped. One key issue is a pay raise for teachers who've been on the job for 6.5 years or longer. The union says the school board's proposal would treat those longtime teachers unfairly. Florida wildlife officials say 538 manatees were found dead in the state's waterways last year. That's the third highest annual death toll on record for manatees. Watercraft collisions killed 106 of those manatees last year. Of the 538 who died, red tide was also a significant factor in their deaths. President Trump spoke last night in Nashville, Tennessee, to the convention of the American Farm Bureau Federation, and he said that he signed into law last month tax cuts of $5.5 trillion, with most of those benefits going to working families, small businesses, and the family farmer. But the AP fact check finds that the president was not close on the numbers. The estimated value of the tax cuts over the next 10 years is $1.5 trillion for families and businesses, not $5.5 trillion. Most of the benefits will go to the wealthy and will increase the national debt by $1.5 trillion. And again, our phone number, if you want to comment about any of these topics, 813-239-9663, and our email address, dj@wmnf.org. Official figures show that the unemployment across the 19-country Eurozone fell in November to its lowest level in almost 9 years. Latest sign that the Eurozone economy has picked up a pace and is doing much better than it was doing 9 years ago. The European Union Statistics Agency says the jobless rate now in the Eurozone is 8.7%, down from 8.8% in October. Former Cleveland mayor and U.S. Congressman Dennis Kucinich filed paperwork yesterday indicating that he plans to join the race to become Ohio's next governor. The outspoken liberal Democrat filed with the Ohio Secretary of State's office. Kucinich is 71 years old, and his trajectory was he was elected mayor of Cleveland 40 years ago. He ran unsuccessfully for president in 2004 and 2008. And he would join a crowded Democratic field in Ohio with a half dozen other candidates running for governor in the Democratic primary, including former federal consumer watchdog Richard Cordray. Florida lawmakers begin their annual 60-day session this morning, and they're going to tackle the state budget, of course. Governor Rick Scott is giving his final State of the State address. Democrats will offer their own version of the State of the State address, and we'll have a full coverage today beginning at 4:30 about what some of the highlights of what Governor Scott said. And again, our phone number, 813-239-9663, email address dj@wmnf.org. In Fort Myers, a sociology professor at Florida Gulf Coast University offering a course entitled White Racism this semester has received so many disturbing emails and voicemails that at least two campus police officers will be watching over the first meeting of his class today. The guy's name is Ted Thornhill. He's an assistant professor. He says he sent police at Florida Gulf Coast University 50 pages of negative comments he's received, and that doesn't include thousands and thousands of comments saying unspeakable things on social media, according to the Fort Myers News Press. The course description says class will discuss ways to challenge white supremacy and examine ideologies, laws, policies, and practices in this country that have allowed white racial domination over those racialized as non-white. All right, so that story going on today at Florida Gulf Coast University. And again, our phone number, 813-239-9663, email address dj@wmnf.org. An Iranian reformist lawmaker is saying that some 3,700 people were arrested in the days of protest in that country and unrest that has roiled Iran for the last few days. South Korean media say North Korea has restored a military hotline with the South in the second reopening of a suspended inter-Korean communication channel in about a week. And The U.S. government is planning to repatriate nearly 200,000 Salvadorans, ending their temporary protected status next year. They left Salvador because of the rampant organized crime and drug crime in El Salvador. 813-239-9663, email address dj@wmnf.org. I'm going to read some of these emails that have come in. David says this. He says, I saw this great independent film, The Florida Project, a few weeks ago, and it does a good job of showing the heartbreak and turmoil that happens when a young child removed from her mother's care by Florida Social Services. Could your guest speak about the film? Is it pretty accurate in terms of the removal process here in Florida? David, sorry I didn't get that in time to ask my guest, Robin. Sorry about that. And here's somebody from the 813 area code says, 11 years is not long enough for that Nazi scum, writes 813. And he goes on to say, hope that people beat the crap out of him in prison. Well, that's something that I don't think is right. So 813, thank you for your email. 813-239-9663, email address dj@wmnf.org. And we're going to listen to just a little bit of this interview that took place yesterday, where Michael Wolff, the author of that new book about Donald Trump, Inside the White House, the book that talked with a lot of allies of President Trump inside the White House about what they think of President Trump. And let's listen to a little bit of what he said yesterday on CNBC. Basically, he's saying that if this investigation that Robert Mueller is conducting goes into Trump's finances, Trump is sunk. Let's listen in and hear what he said yesterday on CNBC. Well, maybe we'll listen to it. And again, our phone number, 813-239-9663, email address dj@wmnf.org. Org.
He colluded with
but
Russia.
But if he didn't want to win, why would he collude with
as
Russia?
As a matter of fact, I report from inside is people don't think in the White House, don't think that he colluded with Russia, right. At least
but
not
do they think he didn't want to be president?
Strategic sense. But they do think that if the investigation goes near his finances, right. He's sunk. Everybody, again, to a man.
Michael, let's talk a little bit about what our viewers care about, too, the business leaders inside, like Gary Cohn in particular, because that's somebody who a lot of business leaders call to, and they feel like they are talking to a person that they understand and they trust when they're getting there. You had an email that came out purportedly from Cohn that was pretty damning in the assessment of what sees there.
No, it was not reportedly from Cohn.
Saying political pushback.
Yes, it was from somebody who was reporting what they understood to be.
Okay, what they understood yes. to be his beliefs in
yes.
this entire situation.
Yes.
What does this tell us for people who are business leaders who have been talking to Cohn? Where does that kind of leave them?
I think it's that weird thing. He's erratic, undependable. We don't know what he's going to do. In a sense that's good has been relatively good for the business community because there are forces, he's not that interested in this stuff. So he can move this. The tax legislation, doesn't come from Donald Trump. It really comes from Mitch McConnell. And so that's been pretty good. And what they're saying also is, if we get Bannon out.
Yeah, they love that
yeah.
because it's the America firstism, no open trade.
Totally. And there is a lot of, that's one of the funny things about this populist thing, for him to go in as a populist, but to be maintain an allegiance to the business community, to leaders in the business community,
yep.
to billionaires who's the
billionaire chorus. I think
yeah, only people he's really yep. interested in.
Well, that was part of what Michael Wolff said yesterday on CNBC. He's the author of Fire and Fury, the book about inside the Trump White House. And what do you make of that? Our phone number is 813-239-9663. In that book, a lot of people, a lot of high-ranking Trump administration officials, Republican Party officials, speak very candidly about President Trump. And, of course, some people think that Michael Wolff made up the book, and none of it's true. But when it comes to listening for denials, the White House has denied some parts of the book, but others, like Steve Bannon, have not denied it. But it's interesting, I think, to take a look at what members of Congress have done in the last few days. Members of Congress, some of whom a year and a half ago had been heavy critics of Donald Trump, are now gathering around Donald Trump, and there's very little criticism of Donald Trump from the Republican members of the U.S. House and Senate. Now, why do you think that is? Why do you think folks in the U.S. House and Senate who are Republican have so gathered around Donald Trump and have not criticized him? And again, our phone number, 813-239-9663. Now, this news just came in. The ex-sheriff in Arizona, Joe Arpaio, who was found guilty of criminal contempt but then pardoned by President Donald Trump, is now running for the U.S. Senate in Arizona. So that's going to be quite a race and a real test, I think, of the Trump philosophy. If Joe Arpaio, who is so connected to Donald Trump, runs for U.S. Senate in Arizona, that's going to be the seat that John McCain or Jeff Flake, I guess it's Jeff Flake's seat that he's running for. It'll be a real test of President Trump's philosophy. Will Joe Arpaio be able to win in Arizona? But I'm just curious, why do you think that so few Republicans have been critical of President Trump? It's hard to find an elected Republican, with the exception of a few people like Jeff Flake and a few others, but most elected Republicans have been very quiet about the allegations in the book, about the steps taken by President Trump. We don't really see elected Republicans critical of President Trump. Why do you think that is? 813-239-9663. Email address dj@wmnf.org. And we're going to take some phone calls, and let's go to Carlos in Tampa. Hey, Carlos, you're on WMNF. What would you like to say?
Hey, Rob, very quick. If anybody needs to develop their ideas, please listen to this station, especially the program on Friday between 12 to 1 o'clock. That's all I have to say. One of the best, I forgot the name of the professor. I listened to him this past Friday. Excellent. Perfect, perfect. If anybody wants to develop their ideas, listen to that guy, and then we will know why the Republicans they are doing why they are doing.
All right, so you're talking about Daniel Ruth's show on Friday.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Excellent. Perfect.
Okay.
One of the best. Thank you, sir.
He is very good. Daniel Ruth, who's a columnist at the Tampa Bay Times, now hosting a show here on Fridays from noon till 1 o'clock, so he always does a great show. Carlos, thanks a lot. Let's go to Mary in Safety Harbor. Hi, Mary, you're on. What would you like to say?
Hey, how's it going?
Good.
I was responding to your question about why the Republican senators and congressional representatives are not responding to the critique in the book and others. And, I've asked myself that question a lot. I call them on a periodic basis and say, put country over party. But I think, frankly, it's self-interest, don't you think?
Well,
if they respond to him, and if their Republican brand is further harmed, then they are going to be harmed, putting themselves and their positions in jeopardy.
Yeah, you know, I remember a day, and I knew a lot of Republicans over the years growing up, and I've interviewed a lot of Republican members of the House and Senate, and the state House and state Senate. You know, a lot of Republicans, from what I remember. And this, my memory goes back 40 years on this, 45 years, is that Republicans wanted good government and they wanted ethical government. And some Republicans wanted people in office that didn't cheat on their wives or didn't talk about cheating on their wives. And there's some allegations in this new book about Donald Trump and what his position is on that. I wonder... sure, it could be self-interest, but I remember a day when Republicans really stood for, they were upset at some aspects of the Democratic Party. They thought that the Democrats were bought off by union bosses. That's what they called them. I don't think that's a fair way to put it, but that's what they thought. And they thought that the Republicans would stand up and bring a clean government. But you think
I remember that day, too, and I'm probably a little bit older than you, but the reality of it is that I think that day has passed. I mean, there's some remnants of that. I think we've seen a few remnants of it in Flake and a little bit in McCain, and maybe even a little bit in people like Lindsey Graham. But I think we're in a new era where it seems that the greed and money and self-serving is a value that has...
Well, then what you're saying is that the Republican Party has no reason to exist because these are no longer independent. These are no longer independent actors that believe in the core principles of the Republican Party from the 1960s and 70s. These are now people who are slavishly devoted to the leadership in Washington, and whatever the leadership says, they're going to follow. So there's no real reason to be a Republican, except if you want to be part of a cog in a machine.
Well, I think that's true, but I think it also, if I can get a little philosophical on this, I think, I was thinking about this morning, there's how do we define our ethics? Do we have an ethic of care, or do we have an ethic of self-serving? Most of the people who support Trump at this point in time that I know are people who care about themselves and their immediate group. Not so much about other people, not so much about suffering, not so much about the people on the margins, but about themselves and their privilege and the privilege of others. And unfortunately, I think we have a societal sickness in a certain group of people, not everybody, but in the group of people who are governing our country right now and in the people who support them, whose interest is in self-serving and what those who they care about and really not so much about anybody else. And I think we have a really sickness of the spirit and of the sense of compassion and morality and ethics. And money has become the god, and I think it's really disheartening.
All right, Mary, thanks a lot. Thanks.
You're welcome.
All right, I'm sure a lot of people will want to comment about what you said. 813-239-9663. Now, here's an anonymous person from the 352 area code says, I'm spreading fake news. He says, Rob, why do you say that Bannon hasn't denied what was written when everybody knows he has already retracted, apologized for what he said? No, 352, Mr. Anonymous, Mr. Courageous. He's not retracted anything. He's apologized, but he's not retracted any of the major points in Wolf's book. We'll have to take a look at that. But he has apologized. He's been very obsequious the last few days to President Trump and President Trump's family. But he has not criticized Wolf's book. I mean, I'm looking for that quote. And Mr. Courageous at 352-585, send me the quote where Bannon actually takes apart Wolf's book point by point, if you've got it. Let's go to Ron in Lakeland. Hi, Ron, you're on. What would you like to say?
Well, you had asked, why are the leaders, the Congress and the Senate, not coming out against Trump with his audacity and his way? I have a theory that they're all tied into illegal sources of funding, as much as they get from corporations and multinationals. I think there's other players involved, and I think that's why they're looking always to undermine Mr. Mueller in his investigation.
What would be the illegal sources of money, or what makes you think that?
Well, I'm thinking, are they getting funding from foreign governments?
Is there any proof of that? I mean, and I'm not talking about the Trump administration or President Trump, but if you look at members of Congress or the U.S. Senate or Republican who are keeping mum about President Trump, what evidence do we have?
I don't. I'm speculating.
Yeah. All right.
You know, you asked, why do you think so?
Yeah. Yeah. I got you.
Okay.
All right, Ron, thanks a lot. Thank you for that. 813-239-9663. Amber writes this. It's not just elected Republicans, but all Republicans. Who on the Republican side in general is speaking out against him? Jeb Bush, former President George Bush? How many of the former Republican presidential candidates from 2016 are speaking out? The only one I know is John Kasich. What about Mitt Romney? Why aren't these people speaking out against him? It is the good old boy network, and the resistance is coming, writes Amber. I think it's fair to say that former presidents George W. Bush and George Bush have spoken out somewhat, not recently, but somewhat. Mitt Romney gave a powerful speech at the beginning of the Trump campaign against Trump, but then had that famous late night dinner in New York City, I think, with Donald Trump, and seemed to make friends with him. But now we're assuming that when he runs for U.S. Senate in Utah, if he does, that Romney will be a Trump opponent. I guess we'll see how that campaign plays out. Let's go to Zena in Tampa. Hi, Zena. You're on WMNF. What would you like to say?
Hi, it's Gina.
Hi, Gina. How are you?
That's okay. Not Gina, but I'll take her, you know, body. But anyway, what I want to say real quick is about the Republicans. I heard on your radio station this morning that Bob Corker, who was one of the biggest critics of Donald Trump, is now like jumping on the Trump, you know, bandwagon. Did you hear that? It was on, I believe NPR reported that.
I did not hear that. I know that Corker criticized the tax bill, but then voted for it.
Then voted for it, and now I understood that he had either some dinner or was on Air Force One with Trump. And my feeling about this is that it's not all Republicans. I agree with that. I think that some key people, like the George W. Bush, is still critical of him. I think it's the ones who are in power or want to be in power. And I, too, remember the time when Republicans used to be the Reform Party. They would criticize the Democrats for being in bed with big labor, and that was probably a valid criticism. So, you know, they're in power and have come into power, and those who are have got, you know, something to protect, the McConnells and others in Congress, they're the ones that are, you know, keeping mum about a lot of very bad things Donald Trump is doing. I think it's just a we need to have another 180-degree turnabout to, maybe make the Democrats the reform party, where, you know, the Republicans are no longer that. They are now the ones, the Me Too party. And you know, my view that they don't want to relinquish any of their power and money. And they certainly have a lot of that.
Well, we know that the bigger Republican donors, too, were the ones that were putting pressure on the Senate and the House to pass the tax bill. Maybe the Democrats should come out and say that we're the party against big money in politics,
and what lose you know, it's like,
and not
money
and not make any money during the campaigns,
not get anyone elected. Well, you know,
Gina, we're out of time.
Okay,
I'm so sorry to say.
Need to vote. Bye. Okay,
all right, thanks. Yeah, people do need to vote. No matter how you want to vote. If you want to comment about today's show, here's how I hope you'll do it. You call up at 813-238-8001 and record your comment on extension 115. And I'll play your comments back tomorrow morning at 11 o'clock. Stay tuned for your hero, Mark Biro, who's coming up next right here on 88.5 FM WMNF.